The origins of the oldest continuous parliament in the world came from rape, from pillage, from fire, and from fear.
The York Times!
In Anno Domini, now Christian era, 793, ships carrying some of the finest sailors in the world arrived off the coast of Northumberland. The Norsemen, Northmen or Vikings, had left their homeland for, it seems, a number of reasons. Norway was apparently running out of agricultural land in the face of a growing population. It was a mountainous country with sandy soil, not good for farming. Only the eldest son inherited the family farm, so siblings had to look elsewhere. Vikings, like the Spartan people of Greece, put great value in physical prowess, in fighting ability. They may have come before, but the attack on the monastery at Lindisfarne was particularly vicious. A sudden assault from the sea, with the monks slaughtered, drowned or enslaved, and the church treasures seized. It took some time, but gradually word of the attack spread along the eastern seaboard of the British Isles. It had perhaps served its purpose to strike terrible fear into the hearts of all the inhabitants. 2 years later, Irish and Welsh annalists record the appearance of the Northmen in their dragon ships in the Irish Sea. Their hegemony of the Manx was about to begin.
It may be the subject of a school children's concert these days, but back then the glimpse of sails on the horizon probably would have caused panic. There may have been some resistance, but in the main there would have been little to stop the invaders charging up the shingle beach. Their progress would have been inexorable and stoppable. They were fighting men up against the villagers, fishermen. The Norsemen stretched their ambitions towards Europe and also to the west. The Isle of Man was in an ideal position to profit from trade between Ireland and the Scottish Islands. It was on the sailing route between Scandinavia and Ireland. And as today, it's a green and pleasant land, ideal for farming and settlement, very alluring to the new arrivals. And arrive is what the Vikings did, we believe, for the first time here in 798. The Norwegians were thought to come down the Western Isles, while the Danes came down the eastern coast of Britain. We still find in common use the Norwegian terms fell, garth and gill on the side of Britain. They soon found a small islet just off the west coast of Peel, ideal to develop as a fortified base. That became, of course, Peel Castle. As they consolidated control, they brought their system of Parliament, or tings. There were tings already elsewhere, the Tingvilla and the Lagting in the Faroes. Ting means assembly, a gathering in which laws were made official. And ignorance of the laws wasn't an excuse. The people were expected to be at these assemblies and therefore be aware of any laws that might apply to them.
Much is made of the reaction of those on the receiving end of this violent Viking expansion. But one would imagine it must have been quite an experience for those who had rowed round the north of Scotland. And some have tried to see what that was like. We'll hear from one later, one of the crew of the Odin's Raven that came from Norway to this island 40 years ago. But what were these Vikings' initial impression of this island? I am in a somewhat smaller craft than the dragon ship. I am sitting in a kayak and I'm below the cliffs that run from Bradderhead through to Fleshing, around the corner from Port Erin. Today it's blue skies and a breeze, the sea's a little choppy, and a bit of a swell crashing waves against the rocks. But when these cliffs up above my head, and they come magnificent, are shrouded in mist, they look truly forbidding, truly scary. Those newly arrived wouldn't have known much about this place, apart from talks they'd heard, didn't know who the inhabitants were they warlike? Was there a beach where they could draw their boats up? If the fog was down, they would have been groping their way carefully up this coast. The crew, we get the impressions they were all fearless. Well, one or two might have been those that were left a little option, but to leave home as there was no real place for them there. There was no land for them to farm. They had to go and look for somewhere else. They may have been deeply apprehensive, scared even. Yes, scared probably. This is a mighty place. The cliffs are ponderous in their mass. The grasses come tumbling down their side. Presumably, they're much the same as they would have been then. There would have been as there are now. Seals! There, over there, there are guillemots. There's a group of them over there on the water. Basking sharks. I haven't seen any today. Probably they were around. Even whales, orcas, and lots of fish.
She has no house to lay her guest in, but one chair bed for all to rest in, that the pale suns and the stray birds nest in.
What was it like to sit in an open vessel for weeks, you know, sometimes violent sea? Well, a group of Manx and Norwegians know, because they came together for the Manx Millennium in 1979, sailing a two-thirds replica of the Godstad vessel from Norway to the island. Robin Bigland, the inspiration for the extraordinary voyage, was in the crew.
Everything we had to do was to be done in front of everybody else in the crew. Obviously, because there's no cover, it's a rowing boat. So in order to get over that problem, they told us that we should, in fact, train naked, because that got over any embarrassment that people might feel about, because you were concentrating on the training and getting the job done. And so, you know, I mean, the fact you were doing it naked was really irrelevant. I don't suppose that galley slaves bothered much about the fact that they were naked when they were chained to when they just got on with rowing. So, I mean, it was just a sensible thought, because, you know, you understand that all bodily functions and things have to be completed in front of other people. But if you don't make sure that, you know, you keep yourself okay in that respect, you'll get ill. So, I mean, and we were 31 nights at sea. So, I mean, you have to be sure that you train properly, and nobody better than the SBS to do that and train you.
So when you set off, did the romance fall away quite quickly and you sort of turned into mission mode, if you will, and started focusing on what you had to do?
You're damn right it fell away quickly, because we were, no sooner we got down the fjord from Trondheim to the open sea, we got about 20 miles out, and the only vessel we saw really on the voyage, practically, because we're very low in the water, you don't see very far, was a fishing boat that came across to us, offered us some fish, and told us that they had a couple of sister ships that were making haste to get back to a place called Ørlesund, around Stad Point, and because there was a very large storm coming, and we were heading straight into it, so we didn't know that that was the case, albeit we'd taken a obviously, we tried to get some weather condition information. But, you know, I mean, things were not like they are today. You couldn't just use your whatever equipment such as we have today. I mean, all we had was a compass, which is basically what the Vikings had, in effect. They had a lodestone that would point north. And anyway, we hurried into Ørlesund and rode out, able to ride out the storm there, but it was a serious one. So yes, I mean, we were pretty quickly disabused of any romantic visions of sailing into the, you know, sunset and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, great. Later, you know, things did get somewhat better, but we had a pretty wet voyage in many cases, and you know, you are wet and there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to get on with it.
Do you remember any moments where a sort of stillness came about the crew or yourself and you could reflect on what you were doing? And
well, indeed, simply because during the night time, the reason we travelled at night a lot was in order to get very close to the next place where we were going to be met and greeted. And, you know, it had been arranged in principle, let's say, turn up at 10 o'clock or something in the morning. Well, you can't just travel a couple of hundred miles and then turn up at 10 o'clock kind of stuff. You have to get there first and then row around the headland or sail around the headland or something and be there, which is what we did. So our sailing would be done at night very much. But having said that, I mean, bear in mind that in those latitudes, you get what the Shetlanders call the simmer dim, which is twilight, really. So that was a big help. And yes, naturally, one had a chance to reflect and take in the beauty of our surroundings, certainly, when it wasn't raining.
The island the Norsemen arrived at was, in effect, Celtic, with Christian overlays, Celtic traditions, Druidic traditions, and also keels, Christian churches. The Vikings brought with them order and a system of judgment. The ting, or assembly, I'm standing on top of our ting, Tynwald, assembly field, looking down towards the chapel. The grandstands have been erected. Flagpoles stand like sentinels on either side of the ceremonial walkway. The traffic goes past. It wasn't the only one in Man, this ting. There were other tings, local tings, probably around the island for local disputes. We're told the ting was designed to uphold social order. Now, the Vikings were warriors and preferred to settle disputes by the sword in the Norse tradition. I'm quoting here, every family and clan was obligated to avenge their members if they died or were mutilated or wronged in some way. The ting enabled families to settle their differences without the need for an all-out clan war, which would have been a bit messy. Without the existence of the ting, there's no doubt that practically every dispute would have been settled in a violent manner. In Norse society, every free man and woman had the right to carry out a revenge killing. The only caveat was that you do it in public. If you murdered someone who had killed a member of your clan in public, you'd get away with it because you were perceived to be an honest man. However, Vikings had to take responsibility for this action and pay any fines owed. The same rules applied if you killed someone in a duel. Now, there were sort of different levels of ting. The lowest level, local tings, community issues. The next level, the affairs of several local communities brought together. Then you had the Alt-Ting, dealing with national matters, and I suppose where I'm standing now, looking up at the big flagpole, this would be a national ting. It was common for parties to try and settle their disputes before being summoned to the assembly, because getting called to the ting was deemed a hostile act. Those who were called knew the verdict would have a terrible impact on their lives. They could be fined, they could be declared a semi-outlaw, or suffer complete banishment. And if you were declared a semi-outlaw, you were banished for a total of 3 years. Being declared an outlaw and suffering banishment as a punishment was an awful outcome for a Viking. Not only were they thrown out of their community, but their property was also confiscated. Also, they couldn't receive any help from anyone in the form of food or support. In other words, they were thrown to the wolves and expected to fend for themselves. As well as suffering from dreadful loneliness, banished Vikings were easy targets because free men were allowed to kill them without consequence. In years past, before the age of media and the onslaught of social media, hearing in person what laws had been passed was for many people an important source of information.
The procession to Tynwald Hill, preceded by a sword-bearer, was the first time a King of England has been present at the ancient ceremonial of the Manx government.
This is an early recording of a visit to the island and to the Tynwald ceremony by King George VI and Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mum, just after the war, 1945. The Queen was sister to the wife of the then Governor, Lord Granville.
Island officials received war service decorations from the King.
The ceremony is colourful and tuneful, with bands and dancing and a fair. Annually, it's a centre point for Manx politics. Theoretically, no law can become law until it is promulgated or read in Manx and English at this ceremony.
The three-day tour was rounded off by a visit to the House of Keys, the traditional Manx parliament.
But in the majority of cases, the Lord of Man or Lady of Man, as Queen Victoria insisted on being known, has the final say, and her presence, implied or actual, on a chair at the top of that hill, or when she isn't here, more often than not, her representative, the Lieutenant Governor, is in charge. Over the decades, the ceremony has been used by protesters. Lord Raglan was famously sodded, in effect some grass was thrown at him. He ignored it, incidentally, that in 1916. But in recent years, and very effectively, costume is used to make a point. In the abortion law debate, the handmaids appeared in their scarlet dresses at the ceremony.
Of course, they're dressed in their costumes of white hats and red cloaks, and it's the red cloaks, of course, that stand up. They walk straight past me. She's wearing a red veil as well, so you can't see the face very well, although you can make it out through the red veil.
Has Your Excellency any further commands?
If any person wishes to present a petition, let him now come forward.
So this now is the chance for petitioners to have this ancient right redress of grievance. And here we are now, they come up the ceremonial walk.
A petition delivered to the Hill has to tick all the boxes. It has to be written in the correct manner, delivered in the appropriate manner, and an MHK has to be interested enough to pick it up and progress it. And decades ago, protesters used grass killer to put a large message on Beery Mountain overlooking the Timwolf Field with the initials FSFO. The message was, "Finance sector, please leave," or words to that effect. We have those on the island who espouse the nationalist cause. What in pragmatic terms would they like to see? Mark Kermode.
In terms of governmental responsibility, the book should stop here. Now, that's not isolationism. That's how all sovereign countries work. And I think if we look at, without dragging Brexit into it, if the people I've talked to from England who did vote for Brexit, they're not necessarily anti-European, but a lot of them are the older generation who did vote to go into Europe and did vote in the referendum to stay in Europe and said, this is not what we signed up for. This is now a federal state and we signed up for a trading agreement. So that's my feeling, is my perception. The people I've talked to is that that's what it's about. It's about sovereignty and a primary fundament of our policy is full independence for the Isle of Man.
So would you no longer have the Queen signing acts? Would you no longer have any reference to the Justice Department in the UK? Is that what you'd want?
Yes, absolutely. And people who say that the Governor has no real powers, he's now able to sign off legislation over here without it going to Westminster. Now, of course, they know what he is signing off. But there is no act passed in the Isle of Man that does not go through.
Could we exist, though, as a small jurisdiction outside, in the Irish Sea, next to all our big neighbours? Could we exist without the UK?
Well, we do, and we did for a long, long time. In fact, the relationship with the UK has been extremely detrimental to us. When we were first acquired in the Revestment Act of 1765, one of the first things was that we were effectively prevented from trading with anywhere but Liverpool. There was, because the customs still existed then, and there was a dispensation given to Manx boats to go into Liverpool. That's where the whole the three-legged ensign comes from. You know, so that's a historical thing.
So who would be Lord of the Isle of Man, if I put it that way? If we broke away, if we were an independent jurisdiction, who would be in charge?
Well, you elect a president. And I'm not talking about the president as you have now, the president of Timwold. You have somebody elected by the people to steer the country as necessary.
So the president would be Lord of Man?
No.
The president would be president?
Yes, exactly. We're Republicans. you don't take an English feudal title and stick it on someone else. You know, that's not the way it works.
Isn't it easier as nationalists to thunder quietly from the sideline rather than suddenly have the enormous responsibility of the Isle of Man in your charge and having to make it a viable entity?
Well, we have been for 50, in fact, more than 50 years now, trying to push the members of government in the direction. And on paper, we've come a long way, but I would say, I know we say every Timwold's the worst there's ever been, but this one really does seem to have no sense of individuality and self-determination. They're just rubber stamping every UK act and directive that comes along. And you may as well say in that case, well, why are you there? Why don't you just be a county of England? And of course, we wouldn't want that at all. But the way they are behaving, you may as well be a county of England.
As we heard a moment ago, the governor at the top of the hill is in command of things when the Lord of Man is not present. But if we wanted to, I understand we could break ties with the mothership. We wouldn't have to have Big Mother giving her consent if, for instance, in a referendum, a vast majority voted in favour of breaking away and becoming an independent nation. Some Caribbean islands did this in the 70s. The consensus is now that they rather regretted losing the benefits that come with membership. We have had on occasion in the past disagreements, quite vehemently on occasion, with the UK. The Broadcasting Act row, in which UDI was seriously discussed. The birching issue, a row with the European Convention on Human Rights through the UK. Homosexuality in the age of consent. More recently, beneficial ownership. On the plus side, it's quite useful having backup in the UK with legislation. There's another pair of eyes in the Justice Department to check over what is proposed from the Isle of Man. And that has proved useful on occasion with things being picked up that had slipped through the Manx net. We would find the kind of barriers that existed between separate nations appearing across the Irish Sea. It's rather like a teenager leaving home. It might feel very good on day one, but then you need your washing done and a bit of cash to get through to the end of the month. Suddenly a chilly wind blows.
This programme has, on this Manx National Day, explored the arrival of the Viking Tingvollur, or Assembly Field, and narrated how various nations have held supremacy over this small jurisdiction in the centuries that have passed. This traditional date today comes from the practice of holding the event in ancient times on Midsummer's Day. That was June the 24th. Well, why are we holding it on July the 5th? Well, with the movement of the calendar from Julian after Julius Caesar to Gregorian, 11 days had to be made up, which is the reason why now July the 5th is the day. Tingvollur's open-air ceremony takes place on the four-tiered hill at St. John's, where the statutes are read out to those assembled there. Some there from curiosity, others from national pride, quite a few from duty. It was suggested, indeed, I understand, that the original idea was that the statue of the Three Legs of Man, which is now kneeling outside the airport building at Ronaldsway, it's a work by Brian Neal, was to be placed in view of this Tingvollur Hill, but its muscular representation of the triskele wasn't popular with some of the powers that be, and after some debate it was finally accepted by the department with responsibility for the airport and placed there. So be it. It is a symbol of strength, of defiance, of pride. Whithersoever you throw me, I stand, it shouts. Well, I'm standing by the bus station site in Douglas. The harbour lies to the south. The eyesore, if I turn around to the bus station car park site, hopefully soon to be transformed, lies to my west. To the east, I can see the sea terminal. I'm just adjacent to the roundabout there. It's straddled by two ugly cannon and small piles of mock cannonballs. For lack of imagination, it probably scores quite highly, but let me suggest an alternative as part of the transformation of this area. A symbol that might echo the three legs at the airport in its stark defiance and statement of independence. There is a portrait of the great Manx king, Ori, which hangs in government offices, Ori Suite. It was designed as a statue that was never actually built. It was never to be, but it could be. I understand for something in the order of £60,000, a past high-ranking harbour official was kind enough to make inquiries, that statue could be created and placed perhaps here, on this site, on a substantial pedestal, axe in hand and gazing with a sneer of cold command towards the main entrepot of the island, the harbour and sea terminal. It would be floodlit at night to catch the eye immediately a visitor exited the terminal. And, as with the laws read out in Tingvollur, Manx, and in English, for those who don't speak the Manx language, on a pedestal below it, perhaps, these words should appear in either Manx or English, probably in Manx. Come on, if you think you're tough enough.
but from a statue that might be to statues that are, and a Tynwald ceremony at St John's that King Ari might well recognise, the national station on this, our national day.